one version. The difference is I accept in a couple of places are in nature. But I've also given you, it will be emailed to you, a two-page outline of the Chavut Maharshal in order, so that which tracks the paragraphs in the Maharshal pretty well. So if you hit a particular paragraph, you're just stuck, for example, you might say, okay, well, that accomplishes this on the outline, let's go on to the next one. And I don't really expect you to get, at the end, I don't have it formatted yet, and so at the point after the part we do, so we're doing it out of order today, because we're doing his categorization today, which is actually in the middle of the Tshuva. Right, that's the second part of today's Makarot, is the Marshal's categorization from the middle of his Tshuva. So when you get up to that point again, all right, that's probably as far as you're going to get tomorrow.
Wait, okay, so you give us in the Sursheet, or Rana sent us, yeah, the Maharshal,
yes,
which is long and has four parts.
Four parts?
Or it's set, I mean...
He creates four and the other
more. Four categories, yes. That's only, that is a piece of a much longer Tshuva.
Wait, and then we have...
So next, tomorrow you have the whole Tshuva without that part.
And then there's the Shemi Shmuel, Yamshal Shlomo.
That's also the Marshal, the two versions.
But this is...
It's the same thing.
And then we have the Maharshal again.
But then it's a Shuz Maharshal right after the Yamshal.
Yeah.
So these two are the ones who are in parallel.
Yes.
But then, where does the long bit? Sorry, I'm...
Okay, so I don't have the printed version, so I have to... Okay, so... These two are parallel, and then tomorrow there's a whole new packet which will have parallels.
And what's this thing?
This thing... The differences were trivial, so I only gave you one version of it, but it's actually part of... We're doing it BAC. So the categorization is the middle of the Tshuva.
Mm-hmm.
Then I go back and I gave you the parallel versions of the beginning of the Tshuva. And tomorrow we're going to do the whole Tshuva, which included that beginning part, that B thing.
So what are we discussing today?
Today we're going to start with the Marik, and hopefully we'll go through the categorizations that he has.
Okay.
And then if we have time, I hope we'll get to at least begin to discuss the questions so that you can start thinking about, well, what do you think the right answer is, and what do you think he would answer based on the categorization he himself gave you?
Okay.
All right, so I pulled his categorization out of his Tshuva, so you have everything that he supposedly thinks about this topic neatly arranged. And then I gave you his question, so it should be really easy to figure out what he's going to say, because I gave you the answer before the question. Obviously, spoiler, it might not be so easy to figure out to predict what he's going to say based on what he actually says. Yes?
To take a step back, where is this Tshuva from the Barisa thing?
That's on the web, somewhere. This came out from somebody in Malay Dumim. I'm sure that everybody can send out the link.
Is it regarding what happened in the Stas Shabbos?
I don't know how long ago it happened. It was somebody wrote a Tshuva. It happens all the time. They said it's an article in the upcoming Tchumen, or the current Tchumen. Tchumen is a Hebrew Israeli journal of Halacha. Okay. Yes.
Usually.
And rarely Kfira. Okay. So I always love
High quality.
It's not good scholarly career. That was very nice description of a different journal. Okay, so the Marik deals with a case where there is a character named Reuven, and Reuven was mefazer ma'utav. He threw his money around to create a condition with some community and with the presumably non-Jewish masters of the city that he could have a chanut there to have a money lending stand. And then it took him. Then 4 years went by, and...
Takes money to make money.
Yes. 4 years went by, and Reuven apparently never went there. Right, so he wasn't a local resident, but he bought a concession, and then 4 years later, he still hasn't taken advantage of this concession. So Shimon goes, and he makes the same deal. Now, all of a sudden, that wakes Reuven up, and Reuven comes and he says he's masig gvul, because everybody already knows this term. And he says, you know what, I even rented a house there. And I intended to go there very soon. Okay, and then the Marik says, I have to give shir, so I'm going to give you a really short answer. Right, so he says. Pardon? Yes. Yes. Okay. So the Marik has a whole set of issues. His opening His opening claim is that he doesn't think that Shimon not going there yet is really a big deal. Mm-hmm. Particularly since he has already rented a house. But his first point is that he treats the possession of this concession and the consequent exclusivity as a property right that you can't surrender until you get rid. The person doesn't surrender, right? So he assumes that when you bought it, you right the purchase of the halva from the right to be melave from the Adona Ir and from the Tzibur carried with it an implication of exclusivity. And lechora, that really isn't disputed, that it carries with it an implication of exclusivity. And the only question is whether he has surrendered it because of desuetude, right? Because he's never used it. Right, he says no. And particularly since he's rented a house, and it seems to him that for these purposes, even if there's a dispute about whether renting a house gives you citizenship in a city, but it certainly gives you enough of a presence to say that you have not abandoned your mining claim, essentially. Right. So he has a concession there, and you might say, well, it's been 4 years; you haven't gone there, so we will treat that as constructive abandonment, even though you never said I'm abandoning it. That right. But if you rented a house, obviously you haven't abandoned it. Right. That's the first part which doesn't overwhelmingly interest us. Okay. Then he cuts to what everyone seems to think is a central question, which is, how does this relate to the machloket, at least what we now understand to be a machloket, between Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam, let's say, that's not going to change so much, as to whether there is a problem of ani matech b'charora if you're dealing with hefker. Right, that's fun. Right, Rabbeinu Tam says there isn't. Rabbeinu Tam says that there's no ani mahapik becharora behefker, and Rashi says the case of ani mahapik becharora is hefker. So here's his big point. We're in the paragraph that begins with Shimon HaBach. He says Ela afilu divrei Rabbeinu Yaakov shapirish dafka becharora shel bala bayis v'ani mishapik lihistaker eslo kedei sheyitein lo charora zu bischira so uva charor v'kidma v'nistaker levala bayis becharora zu hasam udinikar Rashi v'shum sheyuchal limsov makam acher. So here is his first chiddush. He says, "Pshita dehach emode, dehach lohava lo metziah v'lo hefker, v'yuchal shimen lefazir ma'otzav bisha acher kimo bezeh, dezuzi deinshi avdi le'safsi rusta b'chol malkum asher tidroch kaf raglo, v'chol malkum asher holech sham besa." Money talks, but let's try. What has he done to Rabbeinu Tam? And we said that there were two ways of framing Rabbeinu Tam. It was either Hefker Metziah versus Mekach Schiros, or so he just says, you know what, Hefker and Metziah are just the symbols. The real issue is, right? The real issue is, will you suffer a loss if you do not engage? It, right? If you choose not to compete. And here he says that even according to Rabbeinu Tam, so let's follow that, right? Even according to Rabbeinu Tam, who says that ordinarily this applies to Schirus but not to Hefker. So here, why would Rabbeinu Tam be Moda? Right, what? Yeah?
Because you can become a money lender anywhere.
You can become a money lender everywhere. Okay, why does he need to claim Rabbeinu Tam as Moda? This isn't right. Rabbeinu Tam's whole point is that there's no ani mahapik charora by hefker or metziah. This isn't hefker or metziah. So this is just Rabbeinu Tam's case. So why does he have to claim Rabbeinu Tam as Moda?
Well, he'll go on to make the point that right, Rabbeinu Tam was talking about ena matzoi being, you know, if this is a special deal or something. Like that.
Right.
So that he has to first make the move that you can do this anyway, and then go on to make the move that it's not a special deal, even, or that Rabbeinu Tam would be more even if it's not a special deal.
So Rabbeinu Tam says that you're not supposed to interfere in business. Why are you not supposed to? Rabbeinu Tam says you're not supposed to interfere. Let's take it back one step. Rabbeinu Tam says you're not supposed to interfere with someone else's business deal. Right? That's ani mahapik charora. Why are you not supposed to interfere in someone else's business deal?
Because you could have found it elsewhere.
And that's exactly what this is. So why does he have to say the Rebbe Natan is muda here? This is Rebbe Natan's case. Yes, Rebbe Natan.
He's lending to non-Jews.
He's lending to non-Jews, an assumption that he's lending it to non-Jews.
The assumption is that lending to non-Jews is hefker, and therefore they are dealing, they're arguing over an item which is hefker, so according to a formalistic reading of Rebbeinu Tam, you would say that he can be mehapech and he's not a rasha because it's hefker, but according to this new, more logical and less formal reading of Rebbeinu Tam, just the fact that it's hefker is not sufficient.
Aha, so you have to put in this giant assumption, which he hasn't mentioned. Right? That he's taking this radical reading of Rebbeinu Tam.
Which plenty of people would do.
Yes, you can do that. Yeah. It's just, Iker Chaser Min HaSefer. Yes, Tova.
I thought this was not a case of hefker, so that's why I said justify the Rebbeinu Tam support.
No, Rebbeinu Tam says that if it's hefker, there's no problem.
Right.
And he says, no, even according to Rebbeinu Tam here, there's a problem. But it's not hefker. It is business. This is exactly what Rebbeinu Tam says there is a problem. Right. What's the Havamina that Rabbi Natam would say that there's no problem here? Yes?
I think the Havamina is that you get the monopoly from the Tsar.
Yeah.
It's not you don't purchase it, like you bribe him and establish a relationship with the Tsar, and then you get the monopoly from him. So the Havamina was that it's Aniham Hacharara to take the monopoly from the Tsar that the previous person had.
And that's the Maskana too. Right. Same point. Why? Right, the question? We eat a Havamina that is not Anim Hafik Becharara, according to Rebbeinu Tam.
That's because I just phrased. You could phrase it the other way.
No, but it's his. He says it right. Not only according to Rashi, but even according to Rebbeinu Tam. So
Rebbeinu Tam has much more mitzumtzum definition of what constitutes Anim Hafik Becharara.
But this is it. Under what basis would it not fit? So, Elohim gave one, part of Rebbeinu Tam we haven't seen before. We haven't seen here, but that we saw elsewhere. But I don't, it seems, that's really missing from the...
Do you have an idea?
Do I have an idea?
I thought exactly the same as Elohim, but I've been harping on that for a week, so I don't know.
I'm not sure. I don't really have a good way to read it. It seems backwards to me. Yes, Ibrahim.
Maybe to go off of what Joshua said, and it's a special opportunity. You might think that it's a really special opportunity because you get a state granted monopoly over this whole thing, and that's awesome. And the answer is no, you can get those anywhere.
Yes, I think that's the most likely explanation is that he understands that his last line is deeply implausible. Right? If it were really so easy to get an opportunity like this, Shimon wouldn't go. Right? Shimon wouldn't go off. Wouldn't go be competing so hard for this. So he's constructing the claim. Well, you got money. With money you can go anywhere. But money you can go anywhere doesn't mean that you can accomplish the same thing anywhere.
Right, but that's exactly his point.
Yes.
That, right, even though this is probably Shimon's easiest and best bet.
Good, right? So I think that's the right answer is that formally this meets everything of Rebbeinu Tam's criteria, but practically it's obvious this is a business opportunity. So he just covers it up rhetorically by saying, well, money talks anywhere, so, right? But the problem with that is, if that's true, then pretty much Rabbeinu Tam's whole category gets wiped out because he's just said that, well, you can always buy it for money.
Yeah. I mean, that's what the last of the Havamina does. The last of the Kishkur is also like, no matter what, you can always find it somewhere, and if it's even more expensive, you still can't say
it. Right, that's why he says it. That's the point. It's a hezakmaikur matzia, things that you really couldn't get anywhere else. It's a one-time opportunity.
Okay, so what he does is he takes this case, and he says you might have the Havamina that this. You might have the Havamina that this. Let's try it. Let's make sure we have logic straight again. Rebbeinu Tam says that you are called to Russia if you interfere in someone's business without having a real gain. All right, that's Rebbeinu Tam's position, no? Rebbeinu Tam says you become a Rasha if you interfere with someone, right? If you step in and take someone's job when you don't gain anything by that, because you could get a different job. So Rabbi Tam says, if it's Hefker Metzia, you couldn't get the same thing. So you're not a Rasha. And here you might say, oh look, this is just like Hefker Metzia, so you're not a Rasha. Right? Because obviously this is a great deal. And the answer is no. There's no such thing as a great deal for a money lending thing. There's always another government official somewhere else who can bribe.
You can make that argument anywhere.
That's right. So essentially, if you buy this argument,
it's a very weak argument.
In many ways, Rabbi Natan's position becomes fundamentally pointless. And as we pointed out before, you limit Rabbi Natan to cases where, if you limit Rabbi Natan to cases where you could always buy the same thing somewhere else, so it also means the other guy could buy the same thing somewhere else. So Rabbi Natan basically comes down to a politeness issue. There's enough for each of you, and it won't be a big deal for either of you. Don't cut in line.
No, we said it was a virtue ethic. No. You made the exact same argument like last week and made it much more plausible.
Okay.
Right? And that is, it's a virtue ethic. It's not about politeness. It's that, yeah, either you can go elsewhere, but because we're good people, and this has to instill good values, we don't do that.
Okay, but the value is fundamentally, so now, you're right, I'm using rhetorical sleight of hand, but the virtue we have here is politeness, essentially. Because you're not costing the other person anything.
No, the virtue is whatever Rabbi Natan thinks, Hasagat Gvul, or whatever, phrase, whatever.
No, but the point is that Rabbi Natan's Hasagat Gvul will only apply in cases where the other person doesn't lose anything by what you're doing. Because Rabbi Natan's Hasagat Gvul now only applies to cases where the same money could buy the same thing somewhere else.
I thought we proved that last week.
You thought that was already implicit in Rabbi Natan.
Isn't that what you said? What else?
Yes.
What was it if not?
But I don't want to be committed to it yet. Because we'll see.
In
but we can
remember. Right, in a Hefker case, not Hefker, in a Metzia case, where clearly the other guy's going to take a loss. And that's what makes it
a
Metzia.
Right. That's what makes it a Metzia. So, right, so it may be that we are, that what we're just pointing out is a paradox from Rabbi Natan. Rabbi Natan says that you're not over a Hasagat Gvul when you damage the other person, because if you damage the other person, obviously you're giving something up, right? Because you and the other person are always in the exact same position.
That's what we said last
time. Okay. Or if you're comfortable with that. Arik makes it explicit. Right, Arik makes it explicit. You could say, you know what? But this is the ground in this case is that, and he could have said the ground in this case is that Reuven already spent lots of money. And he could have started off by saying Reuven already spent lots of money, and Shimon coming in is depriving Reuven of something. Reuven has something that he already spent lots of money on. Right, that would have been a. Well, he doesn't say that. He just says, you know what? You'll get there.
Yeah.
But, okay. You're happy with the paradox.
I mean, I'm not happy with it, but I think he feels compelled to. Everyone feels compelled to address this issue as the Machlokes of Rashi Rabbeinu Tam.
Okay.
Right.
Good. Yes. Avi and Eli. Yes.
Isn't it important to emphasize that from our case that could find it somewhere else?
Uh huh.
It's not that you will, but instead
possibly. So we'll get further, right? His first move is to say that this is just a regular case where you could buy it somewhere. This is a regular case of Mekach, and there's no big deal about finding it somewhere else. Okay, yes, Ellen.
When you say it's a politeness issue, it sounds like Dr. Sheldon, but that's not what he says. So that's why I looked
on. No, that's why I told you the virtue ethic, right? If you have two people who are standing in line, right? So.
Where does that come from? Virtue.
Well, that's where Rabbi Natan's virtue means that you're trying to make yourself a better person. It's that you're a better person if you let the other if you hold the door for somebody without going through yourself.
I mean, the flip side to the Harar is neutral rationale.
Yeah.
So it's not virtue, because like, virtue is like plus one, like rush is like minus 10.
Okay, I'm not bothered by the. Right, it's trying to make you. It's interested in how it affects your character, and we're not worried about the damage to somebody else, because Vidafka won't call you a Russia when you damage somebody else, because after all, it's a zero sum game.
There has to be middle ground between like virtue and like Russia.
Yeah, I don't care. It just affects character. It doesn't matter to me whether we're in the pluses or minuses. Yes, Supreme.
I think you're presuming that he actually cares what Rabbi Natan says, because he spent the entire tshuva explaining him away, and clearly already had the answer before he wrote the tshuva. I think that's highly unlikely.
All right, let's hold off on the editorials for a moment. Yes, Judah.
I think I lost something. What was the Havamina that Rabbi Natan?
The Havamina is that this is a big opportunity, and obviously Shimon wants to go to here, because he doesn't have an opportunity to go where he can't compete, because if Shimon had an opportunity where he wouldn't have to compete, or he wouldn't feel like this, he would have taken it. So the reason that Shimon is doing this is because this is a golden opportunity.
And Kamash Lalan, that it's not, you know, virtuous to...
Kamash Lalan, it's not such a big opportunity.
It's a silver opportunity.
Because if it were a real opportunity, And then he'd say Rabbeinu Tam would have to tell you, go for it. Because he thinks Rabbeinu Tam doesn't care about Hefker Metzia. All Rabbeinu Tam says is, Rabbeinu Tam essentially says you never have to give up your own self-interest because of this problem. The only issue only comes in when you won't have to sacrifice anything. Okay. Let's Tova and Agenda. Yes.
Is he not playing both sides then? He's saying, if it's a Metzia, let's rely on Rabbeinu Tam, and if it's not a Metzia, let's rely on Rashi?
Well, he's claiming Rabbeinu Tam is motivated to Rashi. No. If it's a Metzia, he says, no, if it's a Metzia, then, yeah, if it's a Metzia, then he'll rely on Rabbeinu Tam. And he'll rely on Rabbeinu Tam, and if it's not a Messiah, then he'll make it a Messiah and still rely on Rabbeinu Tam. Rashi thinks it's always a problem.
No, if it isn't a Messiah. Right? If it is a Messiah, you can rely on Rabbeinu Tam. If it's not a Messiah, you can rely on Rashi.
No, because Rashi, he wants to make it Usser, so Rashi doesn't help at all. He wants to make it Usser, so. If it's a Metzia, then Rashi says Asur, Rabbeinu Tam says it's Mutter.
Yeah, sorry. So if it's a Metzia, he wants to rely on...
No, he doesn't care. He says it's not a Metzia. That's all he does. He says it's not a Metzia.
If it's not a Metzia, so everyone agrees it's Asur. And if it is a Metzia, it's not really a Metzia.
Yeah, that's what he's
saying. That's what he's doing.
If it is a Metzia...
I mean, if you think it's a Metzia, this case isn't really a Metzia, because you can go somewhere else. So it's not considered a Metzia.
Even, right, according to Rashi, of course it's Asur. And according to Rabbeinu Tam, where a Metzia is Mutter, this is not a Metzia. So it's Asur. That's the ongoing theme is it's Usser. Right? This is a tshuva designed to tell Shimon that.
Yeah.
Right? That's the Paramachal was saying. Jenna, what did you want to say? Sure. Okay.
Can I one more thing?
Yes.
Just a question when you were reading.
Mm-hmm.
If you didn't go for 4 years, why is this Shimon stayed away, I'm looking for the best opportunity, and finally after 4 years I feel like Reuben's given up on this, I'm going? Maybe it's you could find this somewhere else, and this one appears open because no one's been there for 4 years lending any money.
Okay, I didn't say that Marik was the most convincing person in the world on this issue. This is his argument.
No, but that supports his argument.
Oh, you say it supports his argument because you think it's just not such a big deal. He's right.
Yeah.
It's not such a big deal.
You wanted to say that Shimon was really actually couldn't, and this is the sleight of hand. I'm not sure it's sleight of hand.
You think it's real?
Possibly. I don't know what the situation
okay.
was.
Okay, good. Let's be agnostic about that.
Okay.
Good. Okay, next paragraph he says, we have a problem, because the Mordechai said that Rabbeinu Tam's Isser only applies to cases where you bought the object at its worth. All right, so that seems to suggest that if you buy it cheap, you're not a Rasha, and that seems to mess him up because he seems to agree that there is some opportunity of economic advantage here. Right? So he thinks the Mordechai is reading it really, really narrowly there, right? But Tom thinks you don't have to sacrifice any self-interest. So his response is, no. Hainu Dafka writes have a new category. Now we saw a parallel category like this in the Mukhe Yosef, but his category is Hainu Dafka Hecha Sheesh Revach Gadol V'Nira Le'inayim Hu. So now, business deals are not metzias unless you get a lot of money. But a business deal which you get a little bit of money is still a business deal. Okay, seems to think that there's some money involved in here for Shimon. And presumably Shimon is, right? That's right. That's what Shimon is doing, because he wants to make money. Yes, Tupra Makhon.
It just sounds like the Mukhi Yosef distinction to me.
It is the same distinction as Mukhi Yosef, but in a different axis. No, this is one of the moves you can make. You can make a quantitative move. It depends how much money.
Or it might be a qualitative move.
Well, how would we make it qualitative?
Nearly nine.
I don't know. It means it depends whether you pay the cash up front or whether you write a check.
Skutsky wants to say with qualitative is that it will become nearly nine, let's say, if you have a very small gain, but you're going to buy up the whole market. And so now you'll be able to make more money off it. So that might be considered...
Uh-huh.
Let's say, if you have a monopoly, it's difficult. It's not the same as buying something cheap. A monopoly is a business opportunity.
Uh-huh.
How well you capitalize on that is unclear.
This is about Kenya. It's about buying.
Right.
Okay. But then he really makes what is the really enormous move, where he says that, well, you know what? Right? Business deals are only mitzios if there is complete certainty about the outcome. But if there's no certainty, so then we just say, well, you know what, you could gain, you could lose, no big deal. Now that essentially means that a business deal is never going to be a metzia. Right? Which essentially what he does is, he returns, he understood Rabbeinu Tam as making a distinction between, we reframe metzia hefker versus business as, can you find it somewhere else, can you not find it somewhere else? And then he undoes that by saying that essentially every business deal becomes, you can find it somewhere else, because you never know for sure. There might always be a better deal somewhere. Okay, so that's it, right? So that's a really big move, right? Midash ein kisveto yadu. Whenever you're dealing with something that doesn't have an absolutely fixed price somewhere else, v'gam ein bo revach kol kach upe'om yimse yoter bezul yoter biyoker. You don't know what the profit is because sometimes it's more expensive, sometimes it's less expensive. Lanias dati nira davar pashut. Always a red flag. The motor of Yaakov, right? The motor of Yaakov, the Mikri Rasha. Okay, so that's a cool move, because we could simply respond and say, find out what someone else would pay for this opportunity. And that's what it's worth. Right? Because we would say it's opportunity cost. But he doesn't say that. He says that, well, you know what, we don't know exactly how much money he's going to make, because, you know, you're going into banking. Sometimes you make money banking, sometimes you lose money banking. So the fact that, you know, even if this would be the opportunity to die for, as read in money lending, doesn't matter as long as it's not certain. Mm-hmm. Right, so that's a very, very big move.
How does he define certain?
I don't know. Absolutely right. I think he assumes that the only case that's left is a moving sale, and somebody is selling $1,000 couch, for $10. Right, so you know this couch costs a lot more. But even then he might say, well, you know what, there might be another moving sale tomorrow and somebody might sell it for $8. Very hard. Very hard to think of a case where it's demonstrable. Right? It doesn't commit him. Right? That's why I say the beauty or disadvantage of this is that it doesn't commit him to anything. Right? Any case that comes up, he can decide it's certain or uncertain. Right? He has shifted this to a highly discretionary standard.
That's good.
If you like discretion, rabbinic discretion especially. Yes, Avi.
Doesn't it also fit us, but it fits us well into the less conceptual distinction that Rabbeinu Tam originally made? That what's different about Hefker, what's really Hefker and what's really Metzia, is different in that you know that you can't get this anywhere. And Hefker is for you. You don't know. It's unknown.
Okay. So you think that was really Rabbeinu Tam's this thing? Okay, so you think this is a reasonable pshat in Rabbeinu Tam? Okay.
And it's not unreasonable, and I'm defending it.
Yes, I know.
I think also once you know that it is less than this, like, set, you know, correct price, then you can buy it, even if you think maybe, I think you could read it less strongly. Like, I may assume, it may be that I could find it for even cheaper somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's cheaper than the set price, then I can buy it.
Set price. Okay.
Meaning, it's
right.
With the different, the fact, you're not allowed, it's only called Mikra Rasha if you can get the same thing for the same price somewhere else. If you know that this is cheaper than what you would probably pay somewhere else, that's fine. Even if there might be something even cheaper somewhere else.
No, you also have to win big.
That would be fine if it's right. If it's cheaper than the standard price, even if. Well, let's turn the page first. I want to turn the page. If you take a look at the paragraph beginning, the sentence beginning Shmamina in the bold, right in the third paragraph down. So, right. So here. So here he says, Shmamina, right, he's talking about the fish case, the cholhecha dimitli the shema lo yafsid, the talinan v'nikra rasha. So now he moved the standard down. Anytime it's possible to argue that B won't lose by failing to compete, then he's a rasha for competing. So now he's given up all pretense of probabilities. All right. Any case in which it is possible to argue that you won't lose by not competing, you're a Rasha if you compete. All right. And his example is, even if the fish that you are, right, you are not spreading your net to get a fish, which he says is da gadol kihanu dechaz rabba bar barchana. Right? There's a great blue whale swimming upstream, and it's the only great blue whale that's been in your river ever. And all right, nope, sorry, right? We just say, you know what? There might be another one. How do you know this is the only blue whale in the river? There's one blue whale, there might be more.
So maybe it's just that he must deal with the case of Amitzia.
Uh-huh.
But he finds it problematic. He's going to legislate out of existence.
Well, he legislates Mitzia. He legislates Mitzia out of existence in the category of commerce.
Yeah.
Right. That right. So he's okay with that. Why it is that he cares so much about business is not so clear, but he is engaged in a campaign to restore regulation of competition in business.
Yeah.
Right, that is essentially.
So he finds it morally inconceivable that we're not to
yeah, it could be.
He finds it economically inconceivable to not protect the supplier, and so for this reason.
Yeah, I think that's it. Sounds like, and this is where we're going. You know, moving into the Parmalchus thing. It sounds like he really, really doesn't like the idea of people competing with someone who has something established. And he thinks that he should be able to prevent that. It could also be that there's something about this case that provoked him. Right? That's right. We don't. Right? Well, we have his description of it, and he said he's writing briefly. So it could be. It could be. You know, we don't. These are the dangers of Chuvot. But once they're published, you can't. You can't focus so much on the details. It could be that Shimon was notorious for doing things like this. And this. And right. You know, this was a chance to put a stop to it. But we. We have to assume that this is a reasonably standard case, and that seems to be where he's going. Then he goes one step further in the next paragraph, and he says, "Well, what if you'll tell me I won't lose money, but it'll take me a lot of effort? So that's also a loss, right? I'm spending my time, I'm spending my effort, so I should be able to write. So by Rabbi Tam's rule, I should say that if it will cost me effort to obtain the similar object." Then I should be allowed to compete in order to save myself the effort. So the answer is no, right? Elavadai pshita afilo hecha she'im barul l'mesov makam acher. Even if you're not sure, you can find it somewhere else. Afilo im timsa lomar she'imsa lo yimsa kim al yedei torah. Afilo hachi mikri rasha. Okay, so that's already. I think again, that's a pretty big chiddush. That we disregard effort and we disregard certainty. Rabbi Tam's rule essentially was you don't have to give up your self-interest. Right? That would be a way of framing it. His answer is no, you don't have to, right? You have to give up your possible self-interest, you only don't have to give up your definite self-interest. And that self-interest you don't have to give up. That doesn't include effort. You have to give up effort. Right? So Rabbi Natam has been, right? So if Rabbi Natam was, I think...
Well, effort that involves money.
Effort. That's what he says, effort.
Effort?
Yeah. Spreading the nets. Right? I'm going to have to pick up my net and walk downstream for a whole parsa.
Some people said that.
So
that's
we've
seen that before,
but
the
pasta
that would keep,
we
make them work a lot.
Well, that's what he says. Yeah. So it's not unreasonable. I guess I would say it's like this: it's not at all an unreasonable pshat in the Gemara, but for that matter, Rashi is not at all an unreasonable pshat in the Gemara because the standard thing is the fish involves hefker. So Rabbi Tam has to play defense on the fish case, but Rabbi Tam does it because Rabbi Tam seems to be that what really motivates Rabbi Tam is this notion that you should not have to surrender your interest for somebody else. Right, and we thought that it's reasonable to say that Hefker Mitzia versus business, Rabbi Natan was really saying is, you never have to give up your self-interest. Marik now says, no, I don't really know why Hefker Mitzia is that different, but I'm going to reformulate it as you never have to give up definite definite financial self-interest, but you do have to give up, you do have to assume risk, and you do have to take an effort. So his principle is much muddier. Yes, have you known?
Okay, no, yes.
Yeah.
You
can ask,
So you're saying the Rabbeinu Tam is working off of the principle of not wanting to limit people's self-interest.
Uh-huh.
I guess in Tosfot in general, I'm wondering, because he brings like the on the surface of the text, the reason is because there's the Gemara in Peah and there's the Gemara in Bava Batra. So, to what degree do you think that these things are, this shita is based on a textual impetus or based on a conceptual, you know, preconception that he's using the...
I can't know. All I can do is look at, you know, right now is look at the vectors. Right, you know, you have, right, the Gemara seems to be pretty wide, Rabbeinu Tam is a narrowing, and this seems to be a widening of Rabbeinu Tam. And that seems to be, you know, and the Tshuva is consistent in that way. Every argument in the Tshuva is designed to expand Rabbeinu Tam. And one of the test cases, ways you could test it is to see is, does he expand Rabbeinu Tam in ways that are not necessary for the specific case? Right, does he just make the arguments that he needs to win this case? Or does he make arguments because he's making a much broader claim? Right, he's trying to redefine Hashgachas Gevul in a way that really basically prevents most business competition with an existing store. Yes, Yish.
So where do you see him saying that if you have to be, the second guy has to be Koreach, then you can't do it?
Isn't that the bottom of the previous page? Am I just reading it backwards?
I don't know.
Last line, right? He says, right, Afilu im tim salomar shu yimtza lo yimtza ki imali dei Torah.
Right. I mean, that's going on...
The second guy.
But not yimtza here, yimtza somewhere else. I mean, he can't say it's too much of a tirchon of move.
Right.
That's not called that's still called Esher Shim Sub Makom Acher.
Right.
He's allowed to do tirchon here to fight as long as it doesn't cost him any money.
No, not allowed. He is not allowed to compete here, even though it will take him serious effort to find a comparable product elsewhere.
Yeah, but I thought you were saying that if it'll take him considerable effort to set up shop here.
No, it's not that.
Okay, fine.
Right, he has to assume risk and he has to assume effort, right? When Rabbeinu Tam could have been read as saying you never have to sacrifice self-interest, the answer, right? He says you have to sacrifice the self. You have to risk sacrificing financial self-interest, and you have to actually sacrifice effort self-interest.
Right.
All right. That's right. That. Okay. Yes, Jenna.
I feel like his problem, like, what's driving him to go to such lengths,
mm-hmm,
to defend Reuben is that, like, he's not seeing this as, like, a mavoy case where it's competition. He's seeing it as someone stealing something. Like, Reuben had a contract for the whole city, and now Shimon's coming in and getting that same contract for the whole city. So it's as if he came in and stole his store. Not that he set up a store nearby, it's that he came and took over his store and started selling his goods, which is why I feel like he's listing the olive tree and the fish and the this, and he only mentions the Mavoy, like, very, I don't know, briefly.
At the end. Okay, good. So let's hold that for a moment, because we'll try and put that in a bigger frame. Hold off one second, because I want to talk what he does in the next page now. So what he's done so far is, he said that Rabbeinu Tam set up a test on B, right? B is the potential competitor. Rabbeinu Tam set up a test on B, and we thought the test was never sacrifice self-interest. He says, that's not true. B has to sacrifice all sorts of types of self-interest. He has to assume risk. He has to assume effort. Now he goes the other way around. And he's going to say, and even when Rabbeinu Tam said that you don't have to sacrifice self-interest, that assumed that A basically isn't going to lose. But now we can, right, but if A already spent money, right, or if it's A's umanut, right? Now these are answers that we find in Tosfot, right? Mm-hmm. Right. This is right. If A put in tircha, or this is A's business, so then B can't compete either. Even though, right? Even within Rabbeinu Tam, right? Even within Rabbeinu Tam. So now it turns out that the only time, pardon? If A had put a lot of work in, right? So then B can't compete, even though it's business, and even though B will lose. Right? And even though B would gain, but if A already put in money, B can't do anything. And if this is A's business, and even though it's a great opportunity for B, he can't compete. All right, so in the end, Rabbi Tam says that you essentially, you can only compete legitimately when A is really not going to lose anything, and it's absolutely certain that you won't lose anything by not competing. And so the spaces, right? So the spaces keep narrowing. And then Rabbi Tam's move, which again, the thing I want you to get is that Rabbi Tam found Rashi said you're never allowed to compete. Essentially, Rashi said, even look, there is a poor guy, and he's chasing after a diamond ring, and a diamond ring which is worth a ton of money to you. Lechora, Rashi would say, tough, he got there first. Right, and Rabbi Tam says, no, right? You don't have to give yourself interest. And the Marik says, no. Right, we're really going to basically take Rabbi Tam's exception limitation, and we're going to widen it out to the point again that the points of dispute between Rashi and Rabbi Tam are shrinking. Yes.
Two questions. First is, why does he feel like, why must he synthesize the opinions? Why can't he just pass them on one?
Because he wants to. Because why can't you just paskin like Rashi? Yeah, why can't you just paskin like Rashi? Because that's a hard sell.
Okay.
And that's a hard sell to paskin against.
It's already 1400 or whatever, and now we have to.
Yeah, it's a hard sell to paskin against Rabbeinu Tam.
Okay.
I think that's the answer.
Okay. The second thing is, why can't he just dismiss Rabbeinu Tam applies, but here we have one. As in, he's coming up with five different ways Rabbeinu Tam doesn't apply.
Yes. So the question
one
is
enough.
The question is this an essay he wanted to write anyway? Or does he realize that each of these points is not terribly compelling, and he's hoping that if he puts in lots of them, you'll find one compelling, or they'll add up.
Or is he just trying to make a general claim?
As I said, is this an essay he wanted to write anyway? Right? Is it an essay he had on hand, and somebody asked him a shaila, and he said, oh, good.
I'm waiting for a chance to publish
right.
this.
Right, that happens sometimes.
Okay, so he was looking, I mean, it's one possibility is that he was looking for a chance to dismantle, or he was looking for a chance to
articulate his understanding of Rabbeinu Tam as a very, very limited,
basically impossible.
Very, very limited.
Okay.
Okay, yes, the Pramacha.
Why is he so fixated on Rabbeinu Tam? He hasn't had it for
250
years.
It's an interesting question that he is really, he is really focused, Rabbeinu Tam. I think Rabbeinu Tam. Yeah, I think Rabbeinu Tam, when he took a position, Rabbeinu Tam really dominates the world.
Panther's
Fist. There we go. Yes, Jenna.
I guess I'm confused about it, because I feel like the whole last packet that we had, everyone was using Rabbeinu Tam as a dissenting opinion and disagreeing with him. Was I understanding that?
So you're right that yesterday, earlier.
Right, so they can do that.
They still, right, the people who still saw Rabbeinu Tam is in their
but,
league.
But, even though they all disagree with him at that time, now when we're here looking back, it's Rabbeinu Tam.
Yeah, I don't think they all disagree. I think what you'll find all the way through is that to dismiss Rabbeinu Tam is really hard.
Right.
To paskin like Rabbeinu Tam is easier... But not even, but you know, Rabbeinu Tam against Rashi is a hard one anyway. But to dismiss Rabbeinu Tam is hard. It's really hard. You don't want to stake yourself on that, especially in financial cases. Because in financial cases, the other person can just say, "But I hold like Rashi and go home," or "I hold like Rabbeinu Tam and go home." Right? Yes. No. Okay. Okay, so right, so the next thing, so after he puts in all the exceptions on B's side, then he puts in all the exceptions on A's side, and then if you look at the next page, the one which begins on top of the Matsinu, so now he puts in a really interesting argument, and he says, "V'imkein hu dekuli alma modu dehechad umnasa bekach." So if it's true that everybody agrees that umnasa bekach is an exception, right, this is the category, right, that we have this category called yori lumnas chavera, which we saw in the Gemara already, that Yorid Lumnas Chavero seems to be, everyone agrees, is a terrible thing. And so it's not unreasonable to say that there has to be a category called Yorid Lumnas Chavero that everybody is moda to. So he says, it seems everyone agrees, and then he says, "Shita dehachinami karina be'um naso b'kach, kilomer lahalvos beribis lo'ovde kochavim, shehu ikar umenos ha'yehudim ha'shochnim b'artzos ha'ele, v'kim'at she'en lehem umenos elohu, v'imkein matzi ruvein la'afkev al shema." That's what Jews do. Now, what's the gap he's covering? Yes.
I mean, well, it's absurd if you take him literally, right? Because then you have one Jew per city.
Yeah.
If you take him literally, both extremes, that you can't fight at all, and that this is the only business Jews have, you're stuck with one Jew per city.
Yes. Right, this is really right.
Someone can never move anywhere else.
City.
Yes.
No, he's got to find a city without a Jew so far.
I will have to have Jews, right? All Jews will have to be in motion until they, right, until you sell. Well, again, you could say, what's the big problem? There are more non-Jews than Jews. But the problem, so you're, what's the real gap he's covering up? The gap he's covering up is that umnaso bekach, does that mean that if I own a mavoi in 40, if I own a mill in 40 mavois, that there can't be any new mills in the city? Right? The Gemara's conceptions of competition are with local businesses. With a local sphere. And here what he's doing it is Shimon, for all we know, is an international businessman, right? He's going somewhere else, right? So to say that you're umnaso bekach everywhere you engage in, right, because you're engaged in money lending, and whenever you compete for money lending, that's called umnaso bekach, right? So right, that basically ends up with a single bank dominating the world. So he can't, right? So I agree with you. There's gotta be some limitation here, and his rhetoric seems to have been excessive.
No, maybe not. Maybe not. I mean, maybe Reuben has two banks, like a pile of one of them.
But we don't know how many other banks Shimon has.
We don't know how many other banks Reuben has.
That's right. We don't know. And so the absence of that limitation is a weakness. Yes, Avinah?
I was just going to say that, I mean, the classic Reuben and the title just is livelier. Right?
So, yeah, so it's
interesting.
So then he goes, and this is where we get to what Jenna said. Right? He says, and this is right. This is of course true according to the person who says Rav Huna Bar Yehoshua and Rav Huna agree, meaning that everybody agrees in the case of the millstone. That's right. But he says there's some people if you say you don't agree, then everybody agrees. You can say Kapasakta Lechiusoi, and he has a new category which is called Midi Dekvius. And Rav Huna Bar Yehoshua only applies to something which is called midi delav kvius. I have no idea what those categories mean. Somehow this is a midi de kvius. And something called tzchora is a midi delav kvius. Yes, Avino.
We were thinking about in terms of the chiluk we had seen earlier between umanut and tzchora. So like if you have a workshop, so like it's fixed, like having sort of a fixed schedule, something like that. It's like you're in a workshop and it has to be there. Whereas if it's just products, you could move anywhere. It's just like a lemonade.
And what's money lending?
I don't know enough about the specifics of money
lending. Neither do I.
He thinks that it falls in kibbutz.
He does. He thinks it falls in kibbutz.
I can argue that like money lending, it deals with your consumer base. And being that your consumer base is up in one place, you can't go to new areas.
He's just making another unfalsifiable category, right? It's just another category that he can use however he wants.
It would have to mean something. I don't know what it means.
None of his categories really mean something.
No, they mean something.
Yeah, okay, but a mill is something that you set up and is location specific, whereas Sechora is traveling merchant train. You can do that anywhere.
And money lending?
You gotta carry all that money.
Yeah, it's hard to carry those dollars.
Not at all compelled. Yes, it's from Achav
and Jenna. Maybe money lending is just a place where you sell money. And so selling money is more like selling a product than it is like selling merchandise that somebody else produces.
It's where you make money.
Yeah, it's money making. It's a mint.
I don't know.
We're money laundering.
Yes, Jenna.
He's like printing dollars.
I feel like maybe money lending is even more kavua than something like a mill, where let's say you have regular customers, but really each week someone decides where they're gonna grind their grains, right?
Yeah.
But with money, I guess I don't know exactly how money lending works, but like.
You have long-term relationships?
Like, have a more long-term, like, maybe someone pays back part of it, but they don't pay back all of it, and then they borrow more, and then they pay back some. You don't switch money lenders week to week, because you have all your, you have things invested there.
I don't know, because I think people did, that's why you had a, I don't know, it's an interesting definition of kvius also, it's an ongoing relationship.
No, that's the only thing, because that's what, before when we were using it, we're talking about peddlers versus store owners, which obviously is not
Yeah, I don't know. I know, I'm not convinced, but I don't know. Howie Zucker, did you wish to say something? No? Yes.
Maybe that could be, it means like how you, what Jen is saying, that you can only make back, you can only like make a profit if you have a long-term relationship or a long, like a consistent business. Maybe like merchantry, if you don't sell here, it's okay to go to a different city and sell. Versus if I set up a mill and I've gone to the expense of setting up a mill in this place, I can't make back what I make my expenses unless I grind a lot of grain right here. And it could be that money lending, like mortgages, right? It could be that if they're doing 30-year mortgages, if someone comes in and cuts in 5 years
mortgages.
In... No, but actually, I'm not sure what the relationship with money... I mean, none of us know how money lending works. But if the relationship with money lender was like that, where you had long-term loans and you paid back and it was interest and the principal changed and you were like, do some forgiveness. And then there was a Federal Home Mortgage Act, so that gave you a little bit, of leeway. But either way, like, you can't... The mortgage lender, the mortgage broker... hypothetically, can't make back his expenses because he has a consistent consumer base.
There are a lot of hypotheses there. Could
That's
be.
It's not inconceivable.
Someone has to know how money
works. I don't know. I mean, I know a little bit from Dr. Television, it didn't seem quite anywhere near that long term. It seemed more pawn, maybe more pawnbroking than Chase Manhattan. But
also, like the Christian could come and like steal his money back if you're turning it too much, or like kill you.
Yeah, well, that's a separate issue, that the relationship
like
often it turned out badly. That's
yeah,
a...
right.
Yes, Elliot.
Is it Freddie Mac?
I didn't
Fanny
take
May,
the
Mac?
I'm elevated, but the only kind of thing I in my head for reference to like money-lending middle-aged Jews is Merchant of Venice, and there it does seem like Shylock has multiple relationships. He does have to wait for Seafaring Ventures to come back, but it's not like he's a set person. He's more traveling and not as Fia.
Uh-huh.
So I would think that it'd be hard to me historically to argue that money lenders, based on this one limited
knowledge
I have.
Venice has
as
a halachic story, we'll put it together. There's Evans' article.
I mean, yeah, right. It is Venice, and it's the right year, within 200 years, give or take.
All right. Yes, Ellie.
Fiction, non-fiction.
I wonder if it's the difference between like the starting costs, where like a mill, you have to spend a very large amount of money for a mill. It's considered to be because you can't lug around your mill, and you pay a large money just for the space.
Yeah.
The same with money lending, where there are a lot of starting costs. Just need all this cash to lug that.
He did buy a store.
Maybe
he has
cash.
Or
what a canoe. We don't know what a canoe is. Okay. We'll leave that. Maybe someone will flesh it out later.
Yeah, according to Oxford Medieval Dictionary. Like,
yeah. Okay.
This is the operative line here, though. That gives everything away, right? Leistim, leistayin, shaliyachol, ruvin, lakev, shimon.
Yeah.
He's working with an assumption that there's always something stopping you from having someone ruin your business?
No. He says that in case of Sora, then no one could stop you. But in this case, someone can.
Oh, is there a double negative there?
Yeah. Yeah, it was a triple negative.
I'm back.
Wait, how do you parse that sentence? I had a hard time with this.
As in Skora, we're certainly, right, certainly for him, it is a milsidic kvusa, but what does that have to do with anything? It should be the other way around.
Yeah, I think I'm right. I think it's only double.
No, but there should be a quadruple negative.
Yeah.
It should be the vado de lohavi milsidic kvusa. Now we call Skora milsidic kvusa. Yeah, all right, mystery. That paragraph is a mystery.
Wait,
no,
I think
you're
punctured this wrong.
Yeah, that's not
going to
help you any.
No, and then period. And then divide that.
No, I don't buy it. Okay, fine. Next one. He says that now he's a new... Now he points out the first time a genuine objection to even his thesis, which is that, you know what, when all this comes down to it, but... What if Reuven's never going to use this license? All he wants to do is resell it.
Which there's no indication.
Which there's no indication
in the
story, but it sounds like there is a.
One second.
Waiting for the market.
Is that the limitation? I thought it was totally different. I thought he was saying. I thought this Haina of Shimon was just that like we can't even apply anything to Hafei Kotar over here.
Because he thinks...
That's about consumption goods, and this is about commercial licenses.
No, I don't think that's what he says is that it only applies, right, when somebody has bought something for himself, but if A buys something with the intent to resell it, and B comes in, so maybe that's not the same thing. That's his argument.
Right.
That's
so Shimon's argument. Hopi is about consumption goods.
Yeah.
And this is about commercial licenses.
No, I don't think it's about commercial licenses. I think it's about It's about business as opposed to as about doing business yourself as opposed to investment. Right? If all I'm doing is taking away Reuben's investment opportunity, not his business opportunity, so that's not interfering with him nusso, not interfering with his livelihood. All I'm doing is diminishing the
I'm not like taking food out of his mouth.
I'm just diminishing the worth of his investment.
Right?
So I think
this is a crazy claim, right? First, this is totally different. This is creating a differentiation that Gemara doesn't even make.
Yes, Shimon makes it right. Shimon, the otherwise unknown Toen, right, is making the implicit claim. We don't have that Reuven doesn't really mean to lend the money. And basically, if you read right, what he's saying is that really what does Reuven want? Reuven wants Shimon to pay him. Right, and that's right. What's really going on in the case is Reuven doesn't really have any intention of moving there, but Reuven bought this license. Right, he realizes this was a mistake. He's never going to move there, but he spent money on it, so he wants Shimon to give him his licensing money back. But Shimon says, "I already spent the money. I spent the same bribes you did. Right, I don't want to pay you protection money in addition. You made a bad investment." So here the Mari comes along and says, "You know that this is an interesting argument. Right, this is an interesting argument. Maybe the whole thing on Imahapik Becharora applies to competition in." To competing with someone's business, but doesn't in any way prevent me from right acting in my own interest, even if that diminishes the value of your investment.
Can you say that again?
Maybe. Anei means that I'm not allowed to compete with your business, but I'm allowed to pursue my self-interest, even if that causes you a loss in your investment. And since Reuven doesn't intend to lend the money, he just intends to sell the license. So all I'm doing when I walk in is I'm lowering the value of your investment. We don't require you to consider the effect of your, generally, right? We don't require you to consider the effect of your business practices on someone else's investment. Well, mashallah, if I invent a the automobile, we don't look at you and say, oh my goodness, now no one's going to buy draft horses. Yesterday I bought 10 draft horses and you're going to go invent the horseless carriage now. Tough. Right? This is a very good argument.
I mean, no one's made that distinction up until now.
Right. No one's made the same, and no one suggested that you're liable for loss of, right, for damaging someone's investment. The whole conversation was about, right, if two people want the same thing for themselves. What Shimon has done is he's reconceptualized the ownership of a license as an investment from a business.
I'm not sure if I got your distinction.
So here's a way of framing it. Let's suppose that you're standing on a street corner in New York. Right? You're standing on a street corner in New York, and one cab, right, you have your hand in the air, and there's a cab coming towards you, and another cab comes screeching and cuts around him and pulls him in front of you to get the business. Right, that's competing with a business. But let's suppose that New York City has a limited number of taxi medallions. Right, and you bought a taxi medallion and you haven't used it for 4 years. So it's against right, the city's not getting the services that you bribed it to let you provide. Right, by paying the hundreds of thousands of dollars. So I walk in and I persuade the city to give me your medallion on the grounds that your medallion has not been used for 4 years. So I'm not competing with your taxi business. What I'm doing is I'm diminishing the value of your investment in the medallion.
And do you have to pay her for the medallion before you take it?
No.
Why?
Because the city grants it.
Because the city, right? The city giveth, the city taketh away. Yes, yes.
The license is there not to, like, use it, but it's the right to use it.
Yeah.
So
I'm diminishing the value of that investment. I'm not in the business of driving a taxi. I invested in the right... In the right to drive a taxi, I have not used that right.
Why is that relevant?
Because so it's not competition in business. Because you're not in business,
but
you made an investment.
But it's an operating cost, though. The license is not operating. It's just
if I were driving a cab, it would be an operating cost. But I'm not driving a cab.
I mean, let's say you think the price of taxi medallions is going to go up faster than the price.
That's right.
But I may start driving a cab tomorrow, though.
Likely.
So that's Reuven's claim, right? Reuven's claim is, I might start driving a cab tomorrow, and Shimon says, no, you're not really going to start driving a cab tomorrow. We all know that, right, that you don't have the time. You're an investment lawyer. You're going to start driving a cab?
Hagufa.
Now, if you were a PhD in English literature, it would be a very, 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 very different claim. But investment lawyers...
Are totally artificial
Yes. But, I mean, all economic... why is it more artificial than the distinction between a mitzvah and business?
No, that's bad also. But, like, this isn't any... Like,
Okay, but you're all, but you understand the Marika Gruzi perfectly because his rhetoric starts,
yes.
accelerating at this
Hevel.
Point. Tana shel hevelhu. Right, this is just hot air. Because first of all, how do you know?